welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, August 24th, 2016. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guests today are Jennifer Armstrong and Lev A.C. Rosen. First up is Jennifer Kaishin Armstrong. Jennifer is a TV columnist for BBC Culture and also writes for several other publications, including the New York Times Book Review, Fast Company, New York's Vulture, The Verge, and Dame. She's the author of The Mary Tyler Moore Show, Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted, and the New York Times bestseller Seinfeldia, The Secret World of the Show About Nothing That Changed Everything, published by Simon & Schuster. And that's primarily what she's here to talk about today. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
Hi. Great to have you with us. Let's begin by hearing you talk a little bit about how Seinfeldia came about.
Well, I, as you probably can already guess from your introduction of me, I write a lot about television and television history. My previous book was about the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And, you know, once that's sort of your niche, that's what's great about having a niche, you know, you're kind of looking for the next thing in the same vein. And to be honest, there's only a very limited number of shows that hold up to book treatment. You can like a show, but that doesn't mean that we need a whole book about it or that you can write a whole book about it. So, you know, I was on the lookout for those shows, and Seinfeld, I think, might be, you know, I chose it, so I guess it's the best show that kind of holds up to that treatment, and it's something that we continue to talk about today, which I also think is very important when you're looking at stuff to write about, like why write about a show that everyone's forgotten about unless it's an incredible story. So, you know, people love to think and talk about Seinfeld, so it was fun to really write about it as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. We at home have all 9 seasons of Seinfeld on DVD, and like so many people, we must quote a character from the show at least several times a week, if not more. And, you know, I was thinking about that as I was, you know, planning to talk to you today, and I was thinking that there's no other show that is so quotable. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think it's a huge part of why it stays in our lives the way it does, and it feels so vital still, as opposed to some nostalgia trap that we just enjoy watching to look back on a time. It permeates our everyday lives still if we're fans of the show. And one of the ways it really does that is it gave us these, I hate to even call them catchphrases, honestly, because I feel like a catchphrase is more like that stupid thing that one character says over and over again. Mm-hmm. Whereas these were like, they were inventing new catchphrases every week. And I think the magic of them was partly that they came up with these ways of talking about a thing that didn't have a name or a phrase before. So that's why they're so useful, is like they really do come up in everyday life and they give us these ways of talking about things, you know, shrinkage or double dipping or sponge-worthy or, you know, so many of these things, there wasn't really a way to talk about them before. And that's why these phrases are so great. They also, there's a lot of things that I think that they do, if you get really analytical about it, that make them work. Like they sound great. Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David have a really musical ear. And if you listen to so many of those, they just sound really good. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Real right. And spectacular. You know, there's a rhythm to them. And they also do this thing where throughout an episode, the characters repeat the phrase several times. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of their way of like reinforcing, like they know they're onto something. And so they keep repeating it, and then you find yourself saying it the next day and week and month, and 20 years later, you're still saying it.
Well, you know, speaking of 20 years later, I was just thinking, you know, so many shows, even movies, I suppose, become dated in 20 years, in 10 years. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like you watch it and you go, oh, I don't know, the hair, the decor, the jargon. But Seinfeld doesn't really, isn't dated still. And what do you think?
Yeah, it's really interesting, right? Because look, we cannot claim that it isn't, that they do not have 90s hair and clothing on that show, because they really do. But this is another one of those things that, of course, I've overanalyzed at this point because I'm talking and writing so much about it. And I think part of it is that, yes, Elaine's hair is very 90s, but it's also really distinctive to her. They have these really, they're almost like cartoons. You know, it's like The Simpsons or something. They have their specific ways that they look. I've joked before, I think the show is secretly all about hair. If you look at, like, they each have a really distinctive, like, if you just saw their hair, you know who it is.
Yeah, yeah.
They each have a really distinctive look, both in terms of clothing and hair. And it, in a way, it almost, like, stops that from being an issue. It's like it allows them to just go off and do their thing in their world. But I think that the issues that they deal with, and by issues I just mean even those basic everyday stupid irritations that they're so obsessed with, still resonate with us. Like, people talk a lot about how, oh, if they had cell phones, it would solve like 90% of the problems that are plots on the show, which is true. It would be, you know, the movie theater episode would be over in like 30 seconds if they had texting and could just find each other. But that doesn't erase the, like, we still have irritations every day, as it turns out. Despite the advent of the cell phone, despite the advent of the computer, I think what's underneath those irritations still resonates with us. And, you know, there's still plenty of others that no technology could solve. You're never going to solve the fact that someone's a low talker and you can't really understand what they're saying, or, you know, any number of other things that go. The rental car, one of my favorite little exchanges is when they go to get a rental car and they've made a reservation, but the place did not hold the reservation. You know, that's like, so, right? We laugh because we're like, even if that exact thing hasn't happened, something like it has happened to us. And I do find myself constantly now, like, thinking in Seinfeld voice, you know, and I think so many of us still do. The other day I was noticing that, like, we had this, I have no idea if this is going to make sense, but we bought toilet paper and it was like these really tiny rolls. And the thing on the package, it says 2 times the size, and it says like 9 = 18, and I'm like, what is that even like? And then another package said 4 times, and I was like, why don't they just make a roll that's like the right size, and then they won't have to do all this stuff? And that just felt like such a Seinfeldian thing. It never ends.
You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong. Her book is Seinfeldia: How a Show About Nothing Changed Everything. And I should say that the views and opinions of my guest and me are our opinions and not the University of California Regents. You know, speaking of hair, it's funny because years ago I did a story on Michael Richards, and I went up to L.A. and I met him, and he was wearing a hat. And it was so odd to talk to him about his character and about him without seeing his hair. And at a certain point, I asked him to take his hat off so that I could see his hair, and the hair popped up, and then he let me look at it, and then he put the hat back on. But, you know, you talk about in the book the personalities of the actors as opposed to the characters, and I remember being really kind of startled that he was so serious and quiet and not funny at all when we were talking, and it kind of threw me off. But in your book, you talk about that. You kind of go into his personality and the other's personality off screen.
Yeah, I definitely got that impression as well. So I'm glad that your impression matched mine. And this happens a lot, I think, with funny people. You know, in my various jobs over time, I've been lucky enough to interview a number of famous actor-y people. And a lot of times, funny people, you know, comedic actors are not necessarily funny in person. I think they get tired. They're like, I don't need to be on all the time, but people expect it of them. But he took his job really seriously, and it seems like at times, you know, I don't want to say it didn't clash necessarily with his coworkers, but I don't think he had the same kind of warm relationship all the time with his coworkers that they all had with each other, because they weren't quite as, I guess, method as he was. It sounds like he was definitely one of those sort of like, I have to go into myself and be this character mm-hmm. when I'm on set, and I can't have disturbances yeah. when I'm concentrating, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it, one of the things, I mean, you can see this if you look at the DVDs, in the extras, one of the DVDs has this reel of times when his co-stars broke, you know, laughed during a scene, and he did not like it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he did not like when this happened. And it's so hard because, like, he's really funny, right? So how could people not break around him? But it really broke his concentration. And there are times, I mean, he's not being mean, but he's very, you know, he's short about it. He's like, please don't do that.
Right.
And it's something you don't necessarily always see. Usually you see those fun-loving, like, oh, everybody's laughing, we're having such a good time. But he really had a specific way of working that I don't think quite made him as friendly on the set as some of the other people. You know, Julie Louis-Dreyfus, I have talked to her before, and she is just, you know, delightful. But some, you know, not all of us can switch easily between those two things, and I can understand that. You know, it's hard, and it's hard to be funny all the time.
You know, it's also funny that David, I didn't realize that Larry David never thought the show would last beyond a few episodes. And it sounds like he wasn't really interested in having it do so at first.
Yeah. And I actually believe that this is one of the keys to its success, is that he didn't ever feel like he needed or wanted this necessarily. So it gives you a really great position of power creatively
mm-hmm.
if you don't care. You know, if you don't care that it succeeds commercially, I should say. He wanted to make the show he wanted to make. And so it really allowed him to say to the network at times, like, all right, fine, you don't want it, then I'll stop making it.
Right.
He was a stand-up. He was doing okay and going about his life, you know, before this happened. And the reason it happened to him is because he was friends with Jerry Seinfeld, who had been approached by NBC. So he didn't need this. You know, sure, it was nice. And once the money started rolling in, I'm sure he appreciated it. But especially at first when, you know, there was no evidence that this was going to last in those early couple seasons. So, you know, he was always sort of ready to walk away. And I think he also has that kind of dark mentality I relate to a lot, which is the idea of like, I'd rather just walk away from this than deal with all of the pressure and like the fact that, you know, seeing the potential to fail more than to succeed. He seems to, you know, that seems to mesh with his personality in general, and that he was always just like, I don't need this. And furthermore, he kept thinking even those tiny first seasons, the first seasons were like one episode, then four episodes, then 13 episodes. And when he heard 13, he was like, I can't do that. Up with 13 episodes. It's crazy. So, and obviously that's hilarious because he ends up coming up with hundreds. In those early days, he was sort of figuring it out as he went along, and he was ready to walk at any time. And I do really think, especially with kind of experimental episodes like the Chinese restaurant, it mm-hmm. gave him the power to just sort of say, like, look, this is the show, and if you don't like it, then I'll walk away.
Yeah, one of my favorite episodes, of course. The
yes.
Chinese restaurant, yeah. I mean, there's so many favorite episodes.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, your book really helped me to make sense of something that I've been feeling, and I didn't really know what was going on with it. But, you know, after season 8 into season 9, the last season,
yep.
I didn't like the show as much, and I mm-hmm. never really knew why until I read Seinfeldia and learned that Larry David left, and
yes.
his influence prior to season 8 is what perhaps made the show a bit more complex and less cartoonish. And after, from season 8 on, the episodes kind of verged on cartoons, and I, you know, it would be funny, but sometimes it would be kind of painful, and you'd just go, I don't know. I think I'll get out season 3 or season 4. You know what I mean? So it's interesting that the influence, that his influence had so much influence that it really colored what went on in the show.
Yeah, he really had pretty tight control of that thing. You know, when he was there, he and Jerry would rewrite together, but I think the fact that he was, like, the showrunner and head writer and nothing else. Like, the thing is that Jerry still had to concentrate on also being in the episode, whereas, like, Larry could only worry about how the consistency of these scripts. So when they had writers writing for them, he would still do a whole pass over it, and he would rewrite a whole thing if he needed to. And when he was gone, that service was no longer available. And it's interesting because I think another thing that was happening in those last two seasons is they had hired a lot of new writers, and the writers were pretty consistent from during those two seasons. It was like mostly the same writers, and they were all really young, and they had all watched the show before. They were all fans, and so it does have this. When you said like sometimes you just get this weird feeling watching it, I think it's like this weird like the way it feels if someone online or something decides to write their own script of Seinfeld. Like, it's good and it's there and it's, you know, but not quite. There's mm-hmm. something, it feels like a copy instead of the real thing. And I think that's sort of what you're seeing, is they were riffing more almost on the characters themselves and on the show itself than just making the show, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And you know, the art of comedy too, you know, with the show, a show about nothing, but there were so many serious themes running through many of the shows, especially prior to season 8.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was thinking as I was reading that, you know, they were dealing with, you know, racism, bigotry, you know, just so many themes. And it was just, you never really felt it. You know, they were able to just really, you know, have you laugh and as you realize what's going on.
Yeah, it's really funny and so much harder. You know, they made it look easy mm-hmm. is the thing. But these were issues we were concerned with in the 90s, right? We were just starting to really deal with everyone's racist tendencies in a real way. I think not until now did we really start doing that, but you know what I mean? Like, we were starting mm-hmm. to talk about things like political correctness and sexism and racism in liberal society. Like, they were really making fun of, essentially. They're making fun of, you know, city liberals. And a lot of what their humor was dealing with the liberal feelings about this stuff, right? And liberal guilt and stuff like that. So something like now, not that there's anything wrong with that, which is the episode where Jerry and George are mistaken mm-hmm. for gay, and they spend the rest of the episode trying to prove they're not, and then saying not that there's anything wrong with that. So that's a very interesting and sophisticated approach, right?
Right.
It's like not talking about the like gay issues per se. It's not about like gay marriage. It's about these guys having this conflict of like, they know that they don't want people to think they're gay, but they also know they're not supposed to feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
So they have this complicated thing. And another one of my favorites that people don't talk about as much is when Elaine dates a guy she thinks is black.
Mm-hmm.
And they keep referring to themselves as a biracial couple.
Uh-huh.
And at the end, we learn he thought she was Hispanic. And nobody is a minority in
right.
this situation. They both just have, like, you know, darker coloring that could go any way. And that's, to me, that's incredibly funny. they find out, they're like, and then they break up. They're like, oh, this isn't fun anymore. So it's kind of that cachet that comes from being so liberal that you're part of a biracial couple, you know? And then when you find out you're not, you're like, oh, this is not as much fun anymore.
Yeah. Well, and Elaine, you know, she's such a great character. And you know, again, reading your book, oh, right, she was one of the guys. They bring in a mm-hmm. female that's one of the guys. And maybe that's why women like Elaine so much, because, you know, she's not really a girly girl. I mean, she is in some ways, but she's really one of the guys. And she has all the same kind of, I don't know, prejudices as the guys do. You know, she wants mm-hmm. the guy she dates to be cute, and she wants him to have hair, and she, you know, mm-hmm. you know, it's,
exactly.
Yeah, really kind of interesting.
Yeah, and I think the key to that is not just, you know, because I don't know, like, you could have seen, we've seen characters before this. It's like, oh, she's a tomboy, she's one of the guys. they didn't really write her that way. It's more that the writers treated her the same as the guys.
I think
that was the key right there, is because it was something I was obviously obsessed with when I was writing this. I've written about feminist issues before, and I adore Elaine. And so most of the writers were men on the show. It's just the way it was. They hired their friends or whatever. It was a lot of white Jewish guys making the show. It's just the way it was. And so I kind of kept asking all of them when I was interviewing them, like, what was the deal with writing Elaine? And a lot of times you hear from guys like, oh, it's really hard, like, writing a woman as if they're an alien and, you know, how could I possibly imagine what it's like to be a woman? But they were all very like, well, we just gave, you know, we had these lists of story ideas that we kept, and we would give her story ideas from our lives too, you know? They didn't really make a distinction between her and the guys in terms of their approach. And I think that's what the key was, is they weren't like, and what would a woman do? And what would a person who is Elaine do is all that they thought. And they even let her, you know, there was some momentary discussion of not having her, for instance, in the masturbation contest. But they eventually decided, why shouldn't she be? And they came up, I felt like she had one of the best storylines in that, because it involved her lust for JFK Jr. And it was a very sort of like hilarious and 90s and New York thing that JFK Jr. was in her aerobics class that week. I just, everything about that is perfect.
Oh, well, I love the book, and it's interesting because I almost never have narrative nonfiction authors on the show. And when this popped up somewhere, I just said, I just have to read that one. I have to talk to her. So I just so enjoyed it. And I wonder if, in closing, you can offer any advice to the writers who are listening, who are perhaps working on narrative nonfiction long form.
Yeah, what I can say is it's something that I'm still figuring out in some ways with each book. I'm like, how do you do this again? You know, it's mostly about just looking for storylines. I think that's the big thing, is to remember you're not just gathering facts. It's not a trivia book. And you're looking for stories you can tell, and overarching themes and things like that. And sometimes they surprise you. So the beauty to me in writing nonfiction is that it can surprise you, you know, because it's not coming from you, that suddenly you hear something and you're like, that's interesting. I need to go and, you know, and follow your interests and see where it leads you when you hear an interesting story.
That's great. Well, thank you so much, Jennifer, for coming on the show.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. That was Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong. Her book is Seinfeldia, How a Show About Nothing Changed Everything. And I loved it. I did. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with Lev A.C. Rosen. Before we go, I want to ask you to check out the website, penonfire.com. You can find podcasted shows there, previous shows. If you go to iTunes, you can find us there too. If you subscribe, that's good for us. And that will also land a podcast in your iTunes podcast inbox whenever we upload a new one, which is usually every week, at least one. And on Twitter, we are Writers on Writing, WOWKUCIFM. So at WOWKUCIFM. You can follow us there. We list upcoming shows there. And that's it. I'm going to take a break. When I come back, we'll have Lev with us. So don't go anywhere.
Funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine, you make me smile with my heart. Oh, your looks are unphotographable. yet you're my favorite work of art. Is your figure less than Greek? Is your mouth a little weak? When you open it to speak, are you smart? Oh, but don't change your hair for me, not if you care for me. Stay
back to Writers on Writing on KUCI FM 88.9. We're broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus, on the web at kuci.org, and on iTunes at College Radio. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I spent the first half hour with Jennifer Armstrong, author of Seinfeldia, and I am back with Lev A.C. Rosen. He's the author of two books for adults, All Men of Genius and Depth, which was a finalist for the Seamus Award for Best First PI Novel, and Kirkus Best Science Fiction for April, and two books for young readers, Woundabout and The Memory Wall, which will be published in September. His books have been sold around the world and translated into different languages. Depth and The Memory Wall will be the focus of our talk this morning. Hi, Lev.
Hey, hi. Thank you so much for having me. This is so exciting.
Of course. Let's begin, as we always do, by talking about your books, hearing about how they came about. Let's start with Depth, which is sort of a noirish dystopian, maybe mystery. And as I was reading it, I, of course, kept wondering what happened in you that brought Depth about.
Well, I think that one of the things I've always wanted to do was write a noir, like write a hard-boiled noir. I loved those movies growing up. Bogart, Bacall, Big Sleep is one of my absolute favorite movies. And I knew I wanted to write something like that. And I tend to be attracted to female protagonists. And it's difficult to write a period piece with like a hard-boiled female PI. It's not impossible. And I considered it for a while, but while I was considering that, because, you know, just wanting to do noir, I thought, what if instead of going backwards, I went forwards? And what if going forward, I managed to sort of bring that sense of the past back into New York City, make it gritty again? Because, you know, I live here and I live in the financial district, and it's not so gritty in my neighborhood anymore.
So interesting. So it started sort of as a noir.
Yeah. I definitely wanted to write noir from the very beginning. That was the focus. And then I just decided, what if New York was, you know, flooded?
Really flooded.
What if that's what brought New York back to the place it was in sort of the 30s and 40s? And then actually, since I do live in the financial district, when Sandy hit, my building was surrounded by water, so I got to see it myself.
Well, you know, I found the setting so extremely visceral. I mean, how could you not? The water levels have risen up to 20 stories or so with the skyscrapers or so, maybe a little more. And now the city is connected by bridges and there are boats. And I started picturing sort of a, I don't know, high-tech Venice or something. But I wonder if you could talk about constructing the city, constructing the setting.
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I grew up in New York City, so I had that sort of going for me from the start. But in terms of constructing this sort of future post-apocalyptic New York, I think that what I really wanted to focus on was the idea of making New York sort of sparse again. So it almost became an exercise in, like, negative space. What buildings am I going to remove? What buildings do I definitely want to preserve? Like, One Wall Street, which is one of my favorite buildings in the city, I preserved and made it a focal point in the book because I just love that building. But then there are, you know, more modern high-rises that are going up. There's a really ugly one, like, a block from me. And I was like, that has to go. So that was... The general sort of idea was sort of, how do I take away to make New York feel almost lonely again?
Mm-hmm. And all the fog helps to do that, too.
I mean, I remember reading somewhere that with climate change, one of the things that's going to happen, and I have no idea how accurate this is, but I read it, that New York is going to start getting fog the way London does. And I was like, excellent, I will use that.
Yeah, well, you figure, too, you know, if you have so much water and you're going to be high in the sky, which maybe, you know, isn't high in the sky anymore exactly because there's so much water, that there would be fog near the water. I mean, it was just really kind of brilliant how you did the setting. And
Thank you.
I'm still thinking about it and kind of makes me a little claustrophobic, but but that's something else. So we're going to jump genres here because we're talking about two books and Depth is your noirish novel for adults, and then you have The Memory Wall, published by Knopf, coming out in September. And maybe you could talk a little bit about this novel and how it came about.
All right. Well, the spark of this novel, I guess you would call it, is that I'm a big video game player. I'm a nerd. And I've always wanted to write a book about someone playing a video game and have that video game sort of be a book within a book. I wanted it to sort of be able to function independently but gain context from what was happening in the real world. And that was the sort of first idea I had. And then a bunch of other sort of thoughts and suggestions came my way, and I ended up with this book about a kid whose mother has early onset Alzheimer's, and he is very upset about it and in denial, and he is playing a video game at the same time, a game that he and his mother used to play together. It's the next one in the series. And his mother is now living at a home, and he becomes convinced that because this game has online capabilities, that one of the characters in the game is his mother, playing along with him like she used to do and telling him in sort of subtle ways that she isn't as sick as everyone thinks she is and that he can rescue her. And so it's sort of a play on the very like old-fashioned sexist like rescue the princess idea, but instead of a love interest it's the mom. And that was the sort of general idea, I guess, is this. That's what started it, this idea of a story within a story. So the chapters are contemporary, and then there's a chapter written in high fantasy that is Nick's character in the video game world. And it's never like Nick plays this character, it's just that character is doing stuff.
So, you know, in looking at the book, you have, you know, the book within a book in a different font. And so when you were writing it, was it in a different font when you were writing it?
It was, and that was one of the things I was, like, really insistent on. I was like, please. And they did such a beautiful job on the interior design. But I had the chapter headings in a different font when I was doing it my way, which they carried over. And they also used different opening line font. It just, I think that it helps to sort of place the reader in terms of what world we're going to be in for that chapter without mm-hmm. actually saying at the top of the chapter, and now we're in the video game world,
right.
You know, it just sort of lets you go into it.
Was it ever in italics?
The video game
world? Yeah.
No, because I have very particular sort of feelings about italics.
Talk about that. Because I do too.
I'm a big fan of italics are only for words that aren't in English.
Uh-huh.
And since this book has some German in it and some Yiddish, I definitely wanted to preserve that. So I tried to make sure that the italics were used sparsely. My editor and the copy editor, definitely, and in fact my mother, who's my best editor, they all encouraged me to use italics a little more than I felt comfortable with, but
mm-hmm.
I think generally my rule is that it has to be a different language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. Yeah, I mean, italics are funny. I mean, I battle that because I like italics, like you said, for foreign language, but if you're, you know, trying to show a different place and time and italics, I don't know, I might skip over the italicized parts, but if I'm doing it, then what, you know, what do
yeah,
I do?
Yeah, well, I love just interior book design.
Mm-hmm.
Every project I work on, every book I start writing, one of the first things I do is I go to the internet, I download a bunch of free fonts that are never going to get used in the actual published book, and I create a really sort of intense title page for the
mm-hmm.
book, just because then when I open that file up and to get to work, that's the thing that, you know, shows up while the document is loading, and I'm like, okay, this is the mood that I set for this book.
Mm.
This is what I'm getting into, and I will spend just hours creating that first title page, but it really helps me, and it means a lot to me. And it's something I always encourage my students to do, and I don't know how many of them do it, but I think that having a strong visual image to really start off your book will always keep you in the place that you want to be while writing, in that mood.
Interesting. So when you were starting out before mm-hmm. your first book, did you do that, and did you submit it that way?
I did. I don't know how my agent submits the books. I don't know if she like runs everything through a standard formatting thing before she sends it out. But my first published book, I remember All Men of Genius, which is sort of Victorian science fiction, steampunk, romantic comedy. I created this really big title page with gears. I found gears that you could put in and like flowers and everything. And it was just this very ornate title page that I created for myself. And oh man, I haven't looked at that book in a while, but they do have gears all over the book, not just in the opening title page, but every chapter they had gear images. So that sort of carried over, which made me happy.
Interesting. Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm with Lev A.C. Rosen. We're talking about depth, and we're talking about the memory wall. So are there conventions you need to stick to when writing for a certain age group? Like the memory wall, were you thinking of a certain age group when you began it?
The memory wall, at first I was thinking a little older. I was thinking sort of that young adult place, but after the first draft, it became clear that the sort of magical thinking that Nick, the protagonist, has just wasn't working for a teenager, so we took it down a bit, took the age down. I think that one of the best pieces of advice I ever got was from my friend Victoria, and she told me that middle grade tends to be about writing children who are sort of understanding that there's a world beyond them for the first time. Other than that, I don't think there's any strong conventions aside from, you know, trying not to use too much naughty language. There was a lot of bad language taken out of memory wall, just sort of innuendos and stuff. But just sort of keeping that sort of sense of someone discovering how big the world is. That's what I think is important in middle grade in many ways. For young adults, I don't think there's that many conventions besides the age of the protagonist. And my husband, who is a librarian who specializes in, he runs a library, but he specialized in young adult books, he would always say there's really not that big a difference besides the age of the protagonist between young adult and adult literature. But I think when you get younger, when you get into middle grade, you have to remember that this is about showing someone's eyes opening in a way, if that makes sense.
It does. That's good. And we talked a bit via email about how you like to jump genres, and you write for adults and you write for kids. And, you know, talk about that and if it's been a problem for you or your agent.
Well, she's never complained. But yeah, I read widely and I write widely. I write a lot for myself, essentially. And sometimes it's myself when I was 12, and sometimes it's myself when I was 8 or 22. But I am always thinking about the sort of books that I would want to read and that which I can't find in the world. And maybe that's just me not looking hard enough, and because I'm, you know, I just want to write it. But I am always thinking of myself as that sort of ideal audience to start with. And when you start that way, and when you read everything, you know, it means you get to write everything. In terms of it being difficult, definitely it's a worry. Like I said, my first book was sort of steampunk romantic comedy, and then my second adult book is this hard-boiled noir science fiction. And so when that came out, I was worried, would anyone who liked the first book follow me to the second book? That's just sort of something you're concerned with, like if the audience is really going to follow you, if you can develop a fan base. That's what you really want to do. You know, you want to develop that group of people who's going to read whatever you write. And some people did. I don't know if everyone did, but a lot of people did. I get a lot of really wonderful emails from people saying, you know, I didn't think depth was going to be for me, but I really liked All Men of Genius, so I tried it. And it was great. I loved it. And that makes me happy in like a way I almost can't put real words to, because it feels like I'm sort of showing someone something really new. And it's almost like I'm really inviting people into my head in some way.
So because then you write in different genres, how do ideas come for you? I mean, did the memory wall come as, you know, this is definitely for middle graders, and depth came as this is definitely for adults? Or do you start writing and see where the story takes you, or how does that work?
Some books definitely start out like, this is going to be for kids. Woundabout, which was a project I did with my brother, who's an artist, and so he illustrated it. That we knew was going to be younger from the start. And Depth, definitely, I knew was going to be older, because my protagonist is going to be older, and it was going to have to be really dark the way a good noir is. But for things like All Men of Genius or The Memory Wall, those were a little more in flux, because that's in that sort of, you know, sort of that 10 and up range. Am I writing this for an adult? Am I writing it for a 10-year-old? Am I writing it for an adult who likes to read books intended for 10-year-olds? You know, like they say that so much of the young adult audience today, so many young adult books are bought by adults who want to read young adult. And I think that what I really tend to sort of focus on isn't so much the age, but the sort of type of person. And so, you know, All Men of Genius, I was definitely thinking about myself in college as sort of a theater geek. And that's where it came from. It became very sort of like, this is for theater geeks, and maybe it's for like 18-year-old theater geeks, and maybe it's for 50-something theater geeks. But that was sort of the underlying thought. And The Memory Wall for me is sort of about, it's not just for gamers, obviously, but it's for people who enjoy a sort of overlap of story, a sort of the idea of changing a literary story with the fantasy inside it. The idea of sort of, it's hard to express, the idea of saying that this isn't just my life is lived not just in the real world, but in a space that I have made. And that was sort of the idea. And that definitely made me think of younger people, because I think younger people have an easier time living in a fantasy sort of space. But I think plenty of adults do it too.
Yeah, interesting. Well, you know, we always talk a little bit about the business of writing on this show. And we originally got in touch because of The Memory Wall coming out. And during the course of our conversation, I recall you saying something about how Knopf doesn't do publicity for middle grade novels. I think you said something like that.
They don't assign publicists.
Right.
There's definitely a publicity department, and they're doing a lot of great work. They're sending the book out. But I don't have a specialized publicist who I've been working with for the first time. And that is definitely unnerving, but it's also been really empowering. For example, I reached out to you, which is something that I never would have done before. It just feels so sort of shameless in some way. But because of Knopf, they call it author-directed publicity, and I believe it's for most of Random House Children's. I got to sort of reach out to people and learn how to talk about my book from a publicity point of view, you know, like writing letters, sort of talking to people, figuring out who to send this book to, and really sort of becoming someone who pushes. And my editor, who talks to publicity for me, has been really wonderful and helpful with that. And it's been a learning experience for sure. It's definitely still scary, and no one has told me exactly why they have chosen to take this approach, but it has been really eye-opening and rewarding, too.
And that's different from adult novels, right? I mean, like Depth, I'm imagining that you did have a publicist assigned to it when it first came out.
Depth, yes, I did. It was a launch title for the imprint, so it was. There was a publicist. And later on, I got another publicist because they were still sort of hiring, and they were great. And they, you know, they sent it out everywhere, and they talked me up to folks, and I didn't have to do that, essentially. And the same goes for Woundabout, which is another kid's book, but from a different publisher, and for All Men of Genius, which is from another publisher. I had publicists who I could sort of talk to and, you know, unload on, and they would set up stuff for me. Whereas with Knopf, I have to set up a lot of stuff for myself, but it's enabled me to make these contacts and meet new people like yourself, which has been actually a lot of fun.
Yeah, it has been. Well, it is interesting how things happen, and I, you know, it happened because we both teach at Gotham Writers Workshop, and someone there told you to get in touch with me, and you know, when connections like that are made, it can be really interesting in a very unexpected way. And I'm glad positive things are coming out of it, because, you know, I think with publishing, all the changes in publishing, you know, there's so much bemoaning of what it used to be like. And all the changes haven't necessarily been bad.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I teach the novel class for Gotham, and I always try to take a very sort of business-oriented approach. I try to really talk to these students about not just how to write, but how to get published, how to operate in the world of publishing. And so I bring in guests. I bring in an agent, I bring in an editor, and I bring in a publicist. And I feel like at this point, if an agent or an editor couldn't make the class at the last minute, I could talk about that. But up until I was put in this situation where I had to be my own publicist in some ways, I didn't think I could give the publicist speech. You know, I couldn't talk about it. aside from saying stuff like, you know, be on Twitter, engage with people, try to, like, be part of that cocktail party in the internet. that's what I always refer to it. It's a cocktail party. You have to talk to people. But with this experience, I feel like now I could do that. And definitely a lot of that has been, the Knopf, the Random House website, they also have sort of pointers, and they give you, like, lists of things to do. And then I have friends who are publicists who have been just amazing in sort of giving me advice. And so I feel a lot more confident in my ability to toot my own horn, mm-hmm. To be my own publicist in some way, and to essentially talk up my book. For example, my brother got married this weekend, and at the wedding there was a principal, a K-8 school principal, and I was pretty shameless in recommending my book got assigned in class, which I don't think I ever would have been before. But after this experience, I feel more confident in my ability to talk up my book and sort of do it without being a real sort of slimy, you know, it feels more genuine now.
Well, you know, a bookseller from Northshire Books in Manchester, Vermont, came on the show years ago, and I'll always remember something he said, which was that as long as a reader hasn't heard of your book, it's a new book. So that mm-hmm. as long as you're talking up your book, no matter if it came out, you know, last month, last year, 10 years ago, that it's a new book for that reader, and no one's going to find it if you don't talk about it.
Yeah, and that's a great, great piece of advice, because I think, especially my students, a lot of the time, like, writers tend to be kind of shy people. They can be a little awkward at times, and I think these days there are so many ways to talk to people online, you know, all the social media, that we need to learn how to take better advantage of that. And when I tell my students, you know, get a Twitter account, a lot of them get very annoyed with me. But it's an amazing thing, especially since for this book, I went on Twitter and I was like, hey guys, anyone want to help me? Mm-hmm. Which is the first time I've ever actually asked for help.
Right.
You know, getting a book out. And so many people said yes. I mean, not just Kelly at Gotham who connected us, but a bunch of other people have been like, yeah, no problem. Here, like, send it my way. I know someone. I know mm-hmm. someone. And it sort of, like, made me really happy about humanity. In a way that it's definitely dulled away some of my cynicism. I'm sure that'll return eventually. But for the moment, I've been really sort of thrilled at the way people are willing to help.
Yeah, that's a great story. We are sadly at the end of our time. I wonder if you have any more sort of advice for the writers listening.
Besides the make a beautiful starting page for your document.
Yeah, that was great advice.
I think that the best advice I can give, and this is business advice, is when it comes time to start querying agents, if that's the route you choose to take, is to just don't be creepy. I have some agent friends, and they share stuff on Facebook, the letters they get, and there's just some, it's amazing to me how unprofessional and sort of inappropriate some of those query letters can be. Not just like, I found you online and I thought you were hot, so I'm querying you, which happens, but just sort of like, I expect you to sign this non-disclosure agreement beforehand, before I even like consider sending
right.
you anything. And my friends get so many of these a day. And so all you have to do is like be professional and not be creepy, and you're already like top 10% of the queries they're going to look at. So that's my biggest piece of advice is, you know, be yourself, be friendly, but don't be a creep.
And on that note, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you. This has been a real thrill.
It's been a thrill for me too, love. That was Lev Rosen. His books are The Memory Wall and Depth. And check them out. Wow, great advice about that title page, isn't it? Lots of good stuff here. This show, along with all the others, will be podcast on penonfire.com. And if you go to iTunes, search us out and subscribe. And if you like the show, leave a review so that'll like raise us in the, I guess, in the ratings and others can find the show. Something like that. That's what I've been told. Anyway, I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and that's all for now. Have a great week writing. Stay in the chair and be well.